Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll talk Flyers and the First Four Tournament with the Deputy Director of Athletics at the University of Dayton, Neil Sullivan. Also, on this picture-perfect weekend, we'll hear about the art and drama taking place at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And later in the program, our second edition of Roosevelt Reads, featuring Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt. Sports, art, literature, and a bit of music, it's what life is all about. Up first, some not-so-sunny news on this Sunday morning. As reported on WISO earlier this week, unintentional drug overdoses are still on the rise in Montgomery County. New numbers released Tuesday by public health officials show unintentional drug deaths jumped from 162 in 2012 to 226 in 2013. Overdoses have been increasing since 2010, but officials call the 71% jump in deaths unprecedented. Bill Warden with Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County says it's going to take everyone in the community to deal with the problem.
We can't stress too much that this is a community-wide problem, and it has to be addressed by the community. And all of those people that are dealing with many of the problems that oftentimes result in accidental deaths and from overdose, they need to pay particular attention right now. And if they can get help for their family members before it's too late, now's the time to do it.
Much of the increase in drug deaths was due to heroin. Its use has been on the rise in Dayton and surrounding communities. Along with the call for community-wide solutions, Montgomery County officials say they'll continue efforts aimed at stopping accidental drug overdoses, such as billboards, public forums, and additional drug programs. Two Clark County men who served in Vietnam have teamed up to raise money to build a granite monument listing Clark County veterans who died in the war. David Bauer and Randy Ark's project has received overwhelming support from the community and is near completion. This past week, WISO's Wayne Baker offered us this Memorial Day report.
David Bauer came up with the idea of creating a memorial to honor those who died in Vietnam and drew a sketch on a piece of paper of what it should look like. Then he and Randy Ark took the rendering to Josh Walters of Dodd's Monuments in Springfield. Walters liked what he saw.
The design involved using the image or the shape of a dog tag and then listing the names of the fallen soldiers on the dog tag. So they wanted it to be quite large and rememberable.
The monument will stand more than 5 feet tall and 7 feet wide. Walters says there's another eye-catching feature to it.
The base that this sits on is about 8 feet long, and it also will have a life-size statue of what's called the Soldier's Cross. It's the symbol of the fallen soldier in war.
Bauer and Ark also received help from the Spradlin Brothers Welding Company of Springfield, and city officials helped find 63 names of fallen soldiers to go on the memorial. Ark says the project is helping the community pay tribute to veterans.
I feel like we're doing the right thing for the right reason, especially since Dave and I are both Vietnam veterans. It's particularly pleasing to us that we've had the response that we've had.
Bauer and Ark started working on the project late last year and have raised more than $22,000 for it, which exceeded the estimated $20,000 needed for completion. The grand opening for the dog tag memorial is scheduled for mid-September in Veterans Park. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
The University of Dayton is preparing its bid to bring the NCAA First Four men's basketball games back to Dayton. Last season, the Dayton Flyers went to the Elite Eight for the first time in 30 years. The First Four games and the Flyers' recent success highlight the growing economic impact of UD basketball for the city. To talk about all of this, I spoke with the Deputy Director of Athletics at the University of Dayton, Neil Sullivan. He told us about the bidding process underway.
The bids opened, I believe, May 19th, and all the membership will have an opportunity, all the NCAA membership will have an opportunity to submit bids. And they are, they'll select sites for 2016, 17, and 18 is what people are bidding on. And we will submit bids for all 3 years for both the first four and the second and third round games. And that announcement and the men's basketball committee will select those sites in November 14, and the bids are due August 6th. So we're in full mode preparing those, to make sure that we've got the bid that wins.
So tell me how the University of Dayton is preparing to submit this next bid.
Well, after hosting for 14 consecutive years, at least of the first four, we've hosted over 100, NCAA tournament games. So part of it's just kind of built into our process on how we frame these things. We submit them often annually, and it's part of it's a technical part of the bid specs, which is, some information to complete that is based on ticket sales, projections, pricing, venue size, capability, and stuff. And the NCAA's got a pretty good handle on that, obviously, coming here so many years. And then the second piece really is about more than just the technical specs of the bid. It's about the community. It's about, having the most passionate fans. And, we believe that, the Dayton region's the epicenter of college basketball. And we got tremendous community support for the first four, the big hoopla, and it encompasses so much more than just the basketball games. We've had science and technology events for kids. We've had free throw shooting contests. We've had people and partners step up with support for all the programs. We've honored the military, active military and their families. So, our goal is not to just do the technical bid specifications that are required, but also demonstrate, the power of our whole community through, it's kind of telling the story of Dayton and why we think we're the epicenter, of college basketball. And so that has a little more softer elements to it that includes, frankly, just storytelling, pictures, videos, things that people do and how excited the region gets for these games.
And clearly one story out of last season is what's called a Cinderella story, the Flyers run into the Elite Eight. So how much does that help you in this next bidding round?
I think two things. I think obviously anytime basketball, goes well, I think the committee looks at them as two separate independent events. However, I do think that what people saw in March when the Flyers went on the run is kind of what people in Dayton have known, all this time, and is that we've got a unique basketball community here, unique spirit. We took over Buffalo, our fans took over Memphis, and I think the Flyers resonated, not only with a national audience, but frankly with a global audience. And I think all that can do is, paint a picture of Dayton, Ohio as the epicenter of college basketball and with, the most passionate fans. And so I think it can only complement and only help people recognize how much college basketball means to Dayton, because I think that was front and center there over those couple weeks with that, run. And so to have the tournament kick off here and then the Flyers reach to the Elite Eight, I think it kept Dayton, the region, in the forefront of the national and global media as being, a very basketball-centric place. So a lot of good stories about the city, about the town, about our fans, about the university were portrayed during that time. And I think all that can do is help the basketball committee, recognize, our commitment to college basketball.
It's been a couple of months, but are students there still psyched? And have you noticed any changes that have come about with this run in the tournament?
Sure. Yeah, I think, some of the, we've run the, run a lot of metrics and things like that in terms of, our media values and our ticket sales are up and merchandise is up and stuff. And a lot of the numbers are still fresh to really, report technical numbers. But there's no question that, a passionate fan base has become even more passionate, and interest in basketball, in Flyer basketball, has reached, new heights, and at least heights that haven't been seen in a while. And, our team and Coach Miller, everyone's ready to capitalize on that. But for the most part, it's people that don't want this to be a one-time thing. We want to try and make this a more common occurrence and think that, we're going to keep pushing in the direction to do that. So we're trying to take advantage of the opportunity that the team presented, for our fans and, for our school and for the city.
I'm wondering how closely the University of Dayton works with the city, and what kind of things do you get in order before you present your bid?
We could not have the first four without the local organizing committee. And J.P. Nassif and Matt Farrell and some other community leaders, Jeff Hoagland and a whole group of people, have supported this kickoff to March Madness, and their support, without them and their input, they're deeply involved with the bid with us, with the ticket sales, the things around it, the hotels, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, the airports. So it is no doubt a team effort. We've got over, 80 kind of government or private businesses, involved that are either providing direct financial support or in-kind support or just support in so many different ways. So there's a team of people that are involved with, putting the Dayton region forward that is beyond just the University of Dayton. You know, this event definitely extends to the county commissioners, city officials, local elected officials. So it's definitely a team effort with really a combination of education, private business, and government all pulling the rope in the same direction to get this thing done. And that's how it's worked over the last 14 years, and we think we've got the model for it to work into the future.
Let me just ask, how many people there with the university working directly on the bid?
Yeah, we probably got 6 to 8 people that are deeply involved from different areas that range from ticketing, from facilities to hotels to marketing to public relations, people that are really putting everything together. But everyone in our athletic department understands the value of it, and it touches everyone in our athletic department in some form or fashion. And Scott DeBolt, who is the director of the UD Arena and our senior associate athletic director, is really the guy that's really managing that process with the NCAA start to finish. But we've got a real solid team.
Deputy Director of Athletics at the University of Dayton, Neil Sullivan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The first 4 games and the Flyers' success have been good for Dayton's economy. City commissioners recently studied the marketing value of the Flyers' run into the Elite Eight. They estimate the city received nearly $73 million worth of free publicity, with thousands of mentions on national and cable television and through social media. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. One of history's most important artists was known for brawling in the streets of Rome 400 years ago and threatening his enemies with a sword. Despite his rowdy reputation, some refer to Caravaggio as the first modern painter. As the Cleveland Museum of Art prepares to restore its own Caravaggio painting, Ohio Public Radio correspondent David C. Barnett offers this introduction to the man whose personal life was as dramatic as the style he helped create.
Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio came to prominence in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, when religious paintings were full of good-looking saints with perfect bodies, often surrounded by sweet cherubic angels sailing in on pink clouds. Caravaggio had a different, more naturalistic vision. Cleveland Museum of Art curator Corey Korkow says that many of the models he used were street people.
He's painting children that he sees on the street with dirty feet. He's painting prostitutes as the Virgin Mary, as saints. And this is a really incredibly aggressive way to treat biblical figures.
And his portrayals of crucifixions captured more of the agony than the ecstasy. In his 6.5-foot painting of St. Andrew on the cross, you see a feeble-looking bearded man being taken down after hanging there for 2 days. The scene is dark and brooding, except for a shaft of light that illuminates the martyr's emaciated body.
It's an incredibly important painting.
Some church officials found Caravaggio's work vulgar and sacrilegious. The artist's personal life also reflected a rebellious spirit. He was a bit of a hothead, actually, frequently getting into brawls on the streets of Milan and Rome. Italian immigrant and former Cleveland journalist Alfonso D'Amelia reads from Caravaggio's police record.
Oggi alla settimana ora, I was on duty with my men when he came by carrying a sword and a dagger. I stopped him and asked whether he had a permit to carry the said weapons. He replied, no.
In May of 1606, Caravaggio's rap sheet reveals that he killed a man in Rome. The Pope issued a death warrant for him. The artist fled to Naples, and that's where scholars believe he painted the Crucifixion of St. Andrew. This centuries-old painting will be restored at the Cleveland Museum this summer before sending it to Sicily as part of an international cultural exchange. Conservator of paintings Dean Yoder will be removing a yellowed coating of varnish from the work and retouching a number of worn spots.
I will be reconstructing some of the areas where paint is missing.
Yoder says that X-rays and infrared photography have revealed hidden layers under the painted surface where Caravaggio made changes. For instance, he redid the figure of an old woman you can see in the lower left corner of the scene. In the first version, her hands were raised, covering a prominent goiter on her neck. In the final painting, the hands are now down, revealing her misshapen throat.
So what does that mean? You know, why did he do that? That's a question that I think we'd all like to know.
Perhaps it was to emphasize a human flaw, a quality in Caravaggio's painting that brought his religious characters down to earth. After his death in 1610, at the age of 38, Caravaggio's stylistic influence remained strong in the generations of artists that followed, including Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Velázquez.
In any way you look at it, you see how amazing Caravaggio was.
The cross-cultural appeal of Caravaggio remains. Iranian political artist Nikki Najumi was recently in Northeast Ohio to speak to students at the Cleveland Institute of Art. His eyes lit up as he looked at a photo of the crucifixion of St. Andrew.
The most attraction is not the story. The attraction is how he painted, how the darkness is against the lightness. It's very dramatic, very powerful.
Visitors to the Cleveland Museum of Art will be able to watch as Dean Yoder slowly restores this powerful painting over the course of the next 3 months. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Coming up in part two of David C. Barnett's report, the Cleveland Museum of Art is preparing to send the priceless painting to Sicily as part of an international cultural exchange. That deal was hammered out after some last-minute high-stakes negotiations last year. In this next segment, Barnett fills in some of the dramatic backstory.
Over 400 years ago, Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio painted The Crucifixion of St. Andrew. It was acquired by the Cleveland Museum of Art in 1976. Curator Corey Corco says it rarely leaves home.
It's absolutely on the do not travel list. Its condition is too fragile.
The fact that this artwork is scheduled to travel to Europe is part of a backstage drama that's played out over the last year. It started out innocently enough with the Cleveland Museum arranging to borrow a collection of ancient art from Sicily, including a golden libation bowl and a 6'4" statue of a charioteer dating back to centuries before Christ. But a few months before these ancient artifacts were due to arrive, newly elected Sicilian cultural officials decided to change the terms of the deal. Claiming they would be losing tourist dollars while the artifacts were away, a loan fee was tacked on to the shipping costs.
That would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But as Plain Dealer arts writer Stephen Litt explains, Cleveland came up with a counteroffer.
The bargaining chip offered by the Cleveland Museum of Art was, no, we'd rather not pay you the money, but we will lend you works of art in exchange if you'll accept that.
The Sicilians were intrigued, but what artworks did Cleveland have in mind? The museum's director at the time, David Franklin, reeled them in.
And really the resolution came when I proposed that we send our beautiful Caravaggio painting of the Crucifixion of St. Andrew to Sicily as a part of a reciprocal exchange in return for no loan fees.
And that sealed the deal because Caravaggio had strong ties to the Italian island, having lived there for part of his last year alive. Franklin himself would end up leaving his post a few weeks after striking the bargain, following revelations that he had lied to his board of trustees about an affair with a museum employee. Still, Lee Rosenbaum, who blogs as Culture Girl on artsjournal.com, credits Franklin for standing firm against the demand for over-the-top loan charges.
You know, the last good thing that David Franklin did in Cleveland was to say, no, we're not going to accede to this, and he managed to find a collegial solution where there would be loans back and forth, cultural exchange instead of cultural extortion.
Rosenbaum has written extensively about what she sees as a growing practice of art museums, both here and abroad, trying to use their collections as cash cows. She's called for the Association of Art Museum Directors to rein in the practice.
I think at some point they're going to have to look at things like Sicily as a warning shot saying this is where it's going and we can't let it go that way anymore.
Timothy Rubb is president of the AAMD, but he doesn't think the problem is as dire as Rosenbaum paints it.
There are occasions when, you know, I will hear about a significant loan fee being charged, and if so, then we would discourage that. But it may be more frequent in difficult economic times, but I do think on balance, museums try to minimize the charges that they pass on to borrowing institutions or in order to facilitate the creation of exhibitions, because it's a two-way street.
For the time being, the Plain Dealer's Stephen Litt says Sicilian authorities are still looking for ways to make money from art treasures.
Now, Sicily has gone on to continue discussing making the loan of art objects from their regional collections a kind of a profit center.
In the meantime, it would appear that the deal to send the Cleveland Museum's Caravaggio to Sicily isn't done yet. The museum is still waiting for details on the environmental and security plans for the painting once it arrives. It's the latest chapter in a tale of a dramatic artist and the drama that continues to surround his work. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt writes a monthly column for the online publication, The Independent. It's now offered as a new podcast. Here's this month's essay.
Hello, this is Mark Roosevelt. I'm the president of Antioch College, and I write a monthly column for the Antioch Independent called Roosevelt's Read. Writing that breaks new ground often has trouble reaching a large readership, but momentum builds as these works find advocates. For the past few years, the hottest such books have been Edward St. Aubyn's spectacularly maudlin novels about the hideous parenting and drug-addled youth of British aristocrat Patrick Melrose. As I write today, St. Aubyn is being supplanted by the similarly autobiographical but remarkably unhistrionic Norwegian author Carl Ove Knausgård, two volumes of whose semi-fictional magnum opus have been published in America as My Struggle. In the early 1990s, if you were asked in an urgent tone, "Are you reading them?" it was very likely that the "them" referred to the novels of Patrick O'Brien. The story of O'Brien's novels' emergence as literary favorites is almost as spectacular as the novels themselves. Originally published in the United States by Lippincott, poor sales caused the publisher to drop the series after only the third installment. The novels continued to be published in Great Britain, receiving modest attention and commercial success. Authors of historical fiction often struggle to find an audience, and despite his mastery of the form, O'Brien was no exception. Finally, in 1990, Norden returned O'Brien to print in America, publishing the 12th installment, The Letter of Mark, in hardback, and its predecessors in a uniform paperback edition. By this time, a small coterie of loyal and influential readers had become aggressive proselytizers, but in retrospect, O'Brien's eventual success seems inevitable. But a jolt of some kind was required. That jolt was provided by Richard Snow, editor of American Heritage, whose January 1991 front-page article in the New York Times Book Review was entitled, "An Author I'd Walk the Plank For." Snow seemed to realize he had just one chance to make his case, and he pulled no punches, calling O'Brien's series, quote, "the best historical novels ever written." He concluded, "On every page, O'Brien reminds us with subtle artistry of the most important of all historical lessons. That times change, but people don't. That the griefs and follies and victories of the men and women who were here before us are, in fact, the maps of our own lives." Snow's essay inspired me to read the first novel, Master and Commander, and I was hooked. I read the next 11 already published volumes in less than a year, and then eagerly awaited the arrival of each new installment. The 20-volume series has given me as much pleasure as any books I have ever read. O'Brien's books revolve around the exploits of the British Navy during the Napoleonic Wars, the same terrain as C.S. Forrester's Horatio Hornblower novels, which are intended for younger readers. The action, as many early reviewers pointed out in a critical way, is pretty limited. It's not at all the main draw. The novels are about character and how character interacts with society and culture. In this case, mostly the character of the ship's captain, Jack Aubrey, and physician, Stephen Maturin, and how they relate to each other and their compatriots in the petri dish-like world of a British frigate, the Surprise. Aubrey is a creative sailor, combatant, and leader much more assured at sea than on land. Maturin is a doctor, a spy, and a leading naturalist who searches for new species of bird and beetle as the Surprise pursues the French to all corners of the globe. And there's something else. An excited embrace of life's possibilities as exhibited by adventuresome and curious folk in the early 19th century. Barely 200 years ago, but worlds away from how we live today. This change in zeitgeist is described well by Anthony Lane when he reviewed the 2003 film Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, which is comprised of events in several of the O'Brien novels. Lane writes, quote, "What the novels leave us with, and what emerges more fitfully from this film, as if in shafts of sunlight, is the growing realization that, although our existence is indisputably safer, softer, cleaner, and more dependable than the lives of Captain Aubrey and his men, theirs were in some immeasurable ways better. Richer in possibility, and more entrancing to the eye and the spirit alike. As Stephen said of the Iliad, this book is full of death, but oh so living." Just so. If you died on board the Surprise, it would not be for want of having lived. Who was the man who created these spectacular books? Perhaps above all, he was hardworking, publishing many other novels, stories, biographies, and translations, in addition to the Napoleonic War series. And he was an indefatigable researcher, steeped in early 19th century life on the sea and on land, a particular expert in the arcane details of scientific explorations and naval battles. He was also an intensely private man, who countenanced few personal questions from interviewers, a bit of a recluse. He's made his home in a small Catalan port in southern France. He was also a fibber. O'Brien manufactured critical parts of his biography. He said that he was born and raised in Ireland, but he was born Richard Patrick Rus to middle-class parents in England. He changed his name by deed poll from Rus to O'Brien in 1945 at the time of his second marriage. For most of his life, he failed to acknowledge his siblings, as well as his first marriage and two children. Whether these personal limitations should matter to us is a subject for legitimate debate. It's sufficient here to note that O'Brien's misstatement of fact went unquestioned, for the most part, until Dean King, the author of several books about the novels, started delving into the historical record, eventually publishing a biography of O'Brien in 2000, a few months after O'Brien's death at 86. This biography is inspiring. O'Brien kept plugging away. He believed in his work and withstood years of disappointment until well past 70 years of age. He received the accolades and financial rewards that his hard work and talent should have afforded him long before. But O'Brien's story is also sad. He so isolated himself from many relationships with his siblings and his own son that his life feels more of a retreat than his admirers might have hoped. An artist such as O'Brien leaves readers the legacy of his books, not his flawed personal conduct. So as time and age have dimmed memory, I will soon return to his novels. Once again, I will be grateful for this wonderful gift of a fully drawn portrait of a world very different from our own, peopled by characters it would have been good to know, and graced with vivid accounts of explorations that take me back to the time not that long ago, when our kind was still cataloging the discovery of unknown species. For a few happy months, at least, these 20 volumes will distract me from the knowledge that just 200 years later, our energies are devoted to documenting the extinction of many of those same species, doomed by human activity, with its origins in an industrial age, which at the time of Aubrey and Maturin was visible on the horizon, but was still far less menacing than the outlines of an approaching French man of war, under sail, preparing for action. I'm Mark Roosevelt, president of Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. For more information about our liberal arts curriculum, where students discover not only good books to read, but also new and better ways of living in the world, go to antiochcollege.org. Thanks.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Thanks for listening on this Sunday morning. Coming up next, The Book Nook.